This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Enron was the symbol of corporate greed in 2001. The executives who ran it robbed Americans of billions of dollars and set a new low for corporate malfeasance, though they didn't hold the record long. But ultimately, the company did go bankrupt. Some Enron execs went to prison. It was a dark chapter in American corporate history that the Burning Coal Theater Company in Raleigh revisits in its latest production. Enron, on stage now through September 25th. Jerome Davis directs the play. He's also the artistic director of the Burning Coal Theater Company. He joins us along with Robin Harris, director of the North Carolina State Dance Program and the choreographer for Enron. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having us.
Also with us are the lead actors. John Allure plays Enron Chief Financial Officer Andrew Fastow, and Nick Berg Barnes plays Jeffrey Skilling, Enron's President and Chief Operating Officer. John and Nick, welcome.
Hello, Frank.
Hi, Frank.
Good to have you here. Jerry, why did you decide to stage this play?
Well, I think it's a terrific device for understanding some of the complexities that went into that scandal. It kind of summarizes them and boils them down into a easily digestible form. But it's also a terrific mechanism for understanding the human element there, who these people were and how they got themselves into this horrific problem. And I think if a work of art is to be useful for a community, we need to not just engage in finger-pointing, which a play like this could easily be, but we need to try to understand how a human being could allow themselves to become the kind of Richard III-like monster that Jeffrey Skilling seems to have become.
And that is the hard part, it seems to me, both first for the writer, not to make this a simple morality play or melodrama, and then again for the director, because it's just so easy to turn these guys into snidely whiplash.
It is. We start with the cast. We have a terrific cast of actors, including the two gentlemen sitting next to me. But the mechanisms that Lucy Prebble built into the play, it's really a vaudeville piece in many ways. It's very fast-paced. It's full of movement, or some would say dance. And we have a magnificent choreographer, Robin Harris, who's worked with us on this show.
Well, let's talk about that, Robin. It's not quite dance. It is movement, but it's built in. How do you treat that when it's not particularly or specifically dance?
Well, I think it is. It's certainly choreography, and it's dance by my definition of dance. But I think what is different about it for a play or for a dance is that the dialogue becomes the sound score for the choreography, for the movement. And there's not in the script, there's not really a definite place where dance or movement should be, and there's not a definite place where it should start, a definite place where it should end. We had to make decisions about what sections would be choreographic. With the dialogue being the sound score, there is the challenge of for the actors and for the effect of the play, to maintain the integrity of the script and the dialogue and the logic of the conversation, because I'm giving the actors an unnatural rhythm and also putting them in physical circumstances which are unnatural. So ultimately, it's up to the actors to make it work and make sense of it, which they did beautifully.
And that's one of the mechanisms you talked about. It's a kind of stylized movement, stylized speech periodically that keeps you from turning these characters into arch-villains.
Robin came up with a really terrific idea of using traders' hand signals, the kinds of hand signals that you see on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, for instance, and has built that into a kind of a second vocabulary in the play that follows throughout the play, not just in the movement or choreographed sections, but in some of the other parts of the play, too. You'll see it appear at unexpected moments.
Well, I think that's part of the genius of it, because that is clearly native to them. It's native to the characters. And then we begin to understand a little bit more about their character and what brought them in. As you said earlier in the play, this is part of what we're trying to examine here, is how do you get into this? No human being wants to be who these guys ended up. How did they get there?
That's right.
And the other hard part, it seems to me, is the complexity of the plot itself. I mean, when the story broke, the hard part for all of us was to try to figure out what the heck was going on at Enron. How did this happen? This is threaded out throughout the play, and maybe you can give us a brief summary, because it's done beautifully. And I wondered how you on earth you were gonna do that.
Thank you. Well, in essence, you know, like any big corporation, Enron had a number of different enterprises going on, and when the quarter came to an end and they needed to issue their quarterly report, they obviously wanted to have a positive number to report. And so they came up with this mechanism. I don't want to give the whole thing away because part of it is kind of the smoking gun in the play, if you will. But to start out down that road, at least, part of the idea was to create companies that would buy the failing portions of Enron, the divisions of it that were losing money, buy them and sort of in effect give them to another company that wasn't Enron, and then when that that enterprise began to turn around and make a profit, then they would sell it back to Enron. It would appear on the quarterly report as a positive at that point, and there was more to it than that, but that's the part of it that was the beginning, and not an unreasonable thing, and not a thing that was illegal, actually. No,
that's the interesting thing. It was partly legal, although I think there were ways in which these shell companies were incorporated and ultimately owned by Enron.
Right, and that's the smoking gun part that we don't want to reveal right now for the audience.
You can do it over and over again, because trying to understand what the heck happened there, I think, and what you're doing is great. Nick, you play Jeffrey Skilling, architect of Enron scandal, and this is a real person. So, you know, in a sense, you've got this actual news figure to play against. Does that make things easier or more difficult for you?
I think it's a split challenge. One of the things is that I don't want to turn a human being into a monster, even though people regard Jeffrey Skilling's actions as being unacceptable. It's important to convey that he was a person in a position where he got caught up with the corporate culture and that he believed what he was doing was right. So again, it's a way to stop him becoming just an arch villain.
And revered for his genius. I think that's one of the things that comes through. He is revered for his genius. And, you know, when people praise you for something that you do well, and it does seem to be bringing everybody happiness on the way, in the process, you really don't see how this – I mean, he doesn't see how this is going to come out. You're a little mildly sympathetic at the beginning.
Absolutely. I think all the way through, his idealism rings through. It's just skewed in the way that it's – making money that isn't really there.
And it becomes the only thing.
I mean, he's having to grab hold of that idea and run with it when there's nothing underpinning it.
John, you play Andrew Fastow. He's responsible for a lot of these, some of the felonious math and tricky gimmicks that inflated Enron's worth. He's also one of the more colorful players, characters in this play. So talk about how you approach that character.
I think early on, I did a lot of looking at. There's a lot of on YouTube. There's a lot of Fastow that you can see, and he was known for instance, being very blinky under pressure or having a high S when he spoke and he was lying. So I tried to do sort of like a Clue Gulager kind of thing early on. I don't know anybody. Nobody ever remembers the FBI, but I do.
From Zimbalist Jr.
Exactly,
about all I remember.
Exactly.
And it was a Quinn Martin production.
And it was production. So I was trying to do a really kind of realistic thing and realize that the theatricality of the piece wouldn't sustain it. It was too subtle. So I dropped it and just went full blown crazy. I just kind of figured, you know, Nick's arc is very different from Fastow's arc, and I wasn't on stage as I'm not on stage as much as Nick is, so we could really engage in a Dr. Frankenstein or actually the two remind me most sometimes of Laurel and Hardy.
Which is which?
But that's interesting because Jerry, you talked about this being a sort of a vaudevillian kind of production as well. So Laurel and Hardy might be a completely appropriate comparison.
There are also dinosaurs in the play.
It's got your raptors.
Velociraptors.
I wonder if we can hear a bit of the play right now. Can you set this up for us?
This is the first time that Skilling goes into Fastow's lair to address some of the issues that are concerning him. I got a problem, Andy. We've got the best business plan, the highest share price, the smartest graduates. Trouble is right now, we're not making any money. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Two guys in a room. You want my help?
What you got?
How are you doing with the chief financial officer?
I haven't found him yet.
You consider everybody?
Everybody with experience of...
You consider me?
For CFO? One of the most powerful positions in any corporation?
Yeah.
You're not a people person, Andy.
You really care about that?
Two guys in a room.
You ever have an affair when you were married?
That's none of your business.
That's a yes.
Is this something you've heard?
No, okay, wait, that's wrong. You like porn?
Do I? I don't even have time to take a dump.
I think porn could save every marriage in America. As internet porn goes up, divorce rate's going to go way down. Now, that is the industry to get in, I'll tell you.
Find the point.
I want to give Enron a mistress.
That's why I like you, Andy. You're nuts.
Nick Barnes and John Allure playing Andrew Fastow and Jeffrey Skilling from the play Enron. It's on stage right now through September 25th, Burning Coal Theater Company in Raleigh. Jerome Davis is here, the artistic director and the director of Enron. You talked about the Raptors, and they play a part in this. Tell us about
it. Yes, they do. It was a financial model that Fastow had created, and he called them Raptors because he was fascinated with the film Jurassic Park. He was kind of entranced by it, and so he called them Raptors. And the playwright's conceit, which I think is a really lovely one, is to take that and run with it. So we actually get to see them physically come to life in the play, and we have a set of puppets that we use that are made out of that appear to be made out of paper, so they appear to emerge from this paper environment that really all of Enron was built on, and I think it was a good idea for the playwright, and I think our puppet mistress, if you will, has executed them wonderfully. And The actors interact with them very well. They're kind of scary.
Well, that's kind of the genius of this play, is to embody something that is otherwise pretty abstract.
Abstract,
the ideas
that's
of evil,
right.
And what they are and how they overtake us all. And as you say, that's the stuff of great theater. It has been played all over the world. Have you paid attention to other productions and how they did it? Was that part of your planning for this?
Well, I saw the London production. It opened at the Royal Court in London, and it was a big, big success. And then it moved to the West End, which is their version of Broadway, and it played for something like a year and a half. It's been touring since then. It played on Broadway last year and was not well received. The critic for the New York Times gave it a bad review. And having seen that London production, I can sort of understand why. There was a real almost Vegas-y quality to it that I think left out that human dimension that Nick was talking about a moment ago. And again, I think that the thing that Shakespeare did that was so great is that he reached for these great lofty heights rhetorically, but he constantly returned to the earth in the comedic characters of the play. And so we had this contrast, and Lucy has done that. She's this young woman, this young British woman who's, I think, still under 30. This is only her second play. But she's somehow managed to find a way of reaching a Shakespearean height with this play, which is extraordinary.
Well, the other thing it seems to me that you have to keep in mind, and again, when it plays in different countries, is the cultural environments that you play in. I mean, we really do still glorify people who get very, very wealthy, and we don't ask a whole lot of questions along the way. So it's a little harder to demonize them here in a place like England that has a different sense of its sort of class relationships. I would think the play might play very differently.
And I think the arm's length, the fact that it was across the Atlantic had something to do with that as well. We're seeing, the results of the Enron thinking today with a number of other financial meltdowns that have happened, and none are precisely, based on the Enron model, but the thinking that goes into business today seems to be at question, really, as we move into the next decade of the 21st century.
Robin Harris, how much, when you're choreographing a story like this, a play like this, do you have to immerse yourself in the story of Enron? I mean, do you have to do a lot of research in the sort of details of that meltdown, or is it all for you in the text and the movement on that stage?
Well, I certainly did research about traitor gestures and looked at visual images of electricity and just...
Which is a very hard thing to see.
Yes, it is a very hard thing to find a visual image for. So, and I certainly studied the script. I think what I tried to do with the choreography is provide sort of visual metaphors, representations of the context that the characters were in, and those visual representations gave more information about the contexts.
And you were able to put that together on stage. And Jerry, when you talked about the questions of the parallels today, it's really only 7 years later. It is those human motivations. Those are the things that remain the same. The idea that once you start playing this game, when you read the stories of the latest meltdown at Lehman Brothers Goldman Sachs, each of those guys at the head of those companies said, it's never about the money. Because you asked yourself, well, after the 700th million dollar that you earned, don't you stop? And they said, well, it's really not about the money. It's this game. It's this math that we're playing. I mean, bridge players who can't stop doing the arithmetic, because that's where the charge is, not in counting their gold in the treasury.
They want to win, they want to win for their circle of friends and impress them, which is not – something that all of us can't relate to. You know, it's certainly a presence in my life as an artist. I feel a competition with other arts organizations. So I think the thing that has to change is this notion of the individual at all costs versus the notion of the community as something to be fought for and valued. And that was at the heart of America when we began building this nation. But over the course of time, as wealth and power has accumulated into the hands of fewer and fewer people, the idea of the individual success has taken precedent. And so I think a play like Enron asks us how does that happen? And how, maybe can we get back to the more selfless ideal?
And paradoxically, as more and more people get hurt and more people are shut out and shut off from the possibility of ever making that kind of money, there's less and less outcry for a communitarian approach or even a regulatory approach to put some halter and some governor on what we see is the runaway greed when there's no restraint.
There is a quandary there, yes.
When you guys let me ask Nick and John, how much of the story itself you felt the news story and understanding the actual mechanism of the Enron collapse you needed to know in order to play these parts.
When I first heard about Enron, I was back in the UK, and so it was very much a distant thing for me. So although I was aware of it, it was only when I started working on the play that I really delved into it and realized how many individuals were affected by it and the enormity of 20,000 employees not only losing their jobs but also losing their life savings, their retirement income. It had an enormous personal feeling. That's why I wanted to both create a character that was sympathetic whilst the story is representing the fact that people lost an enormous amount of faith in the system.
John?
That was very important to me. One of the first things I did was to read the book Conspiracy of Fools, which is about the Enron collapse. It's a 700-page page-turner. It's fascinating. And to understand those entities, Chuco was one of them, named after Chewbacca from Star Wars, and as well as the Raptors. I mean, those were basically derivative projects or products that I still don't completely understand, but...
helped you get into the part.
Exactly. Yeah.
John Allure plays Enron Chief Financial Officer Andrew Fastow in the play. Nick Berg-Barnes plays Jeffrey Skilling. Jerome Davis is Director of Enron and Artistic Director of the Burning Coal Theater Company. Robin Harris is Director of the North Carolina State Dance Program and Choreographer for Enron, a play that is now on stage by Burning Coal Theater Company until September 25th at the Murphy School in Raleigh. For more information, go to burningcoal.org. Coming up, the work of a forgotten North Carolina artist on display in Raleigh. Stay tuned.